This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alec Baldwin, has become kind of a regular on Saturday Night Live, doing his impression of Donald Trump, a portrayal that President Trump says stinks. Baldwin now holds the title for the number of times anyone has ever guest hosted the show, 17 times. Baldwin has a new memoir called Nevertheless, and its publication coincides with the release of his animated movie The Boss Baby, which was number one at the box office last weekend. His character is an infant who dresses in a business suit, carries a briefcase, and behaves like a commanding boss. The character connects to a couple of roles Baldwin is famous for, a ruthless salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross, and a network executive in 30 Rock. We're going to talk about his life and work. Let's start with a Saturday Night Live clip from March 11th. Aliens from planet Zorblat 9 have attacked the Earth. Kenan Thompson plays a military officer, giving the troops a pep talk about how they have to save the human race. But first, he says, your commander-in-chief wants to say a few words. And he steps aside for President Trump, played by Alec Baldwin.
Now, here's the deal. We are going to beat these aliens because we have got the best military, but we don't win anymore. And the aliens are laughing at us. They're killing us, and they're laughing at us.
We know the aliens are killing us, sir. They have the most advanced weaponized technology we've ever seen. What should we do?
Okay, here's what we do. Here's what we're going to do. We are going to bring coal back, okay? We're going to have so much coal, you're going to say, where did all this coal come from? I never knew there could be so much coal.
But, Mr. President, what about the aliens? They just vaporized the entire state of California.
So then I won the popular vote?
Sir, please, everyone in California is dead.
Even Arnold?
Sir, yes, we are dealing with a highly advanced species here. They're from Zorblat 9. Their ships are invisible. They're telepathic.
Okay. No, we don't know that they are from Zorblat 9. I've actually heard Zorblat 9 is very beautiful, very fantastic.
Oh my God, does he have business ties on Zorblat 9?
Alec Baldwin, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on The Boss Baby. Congratulations on your memoir and on your Trump impersonation on Saturday Night Live. So I'd like to start with that. How did you start doing Donald Trump? And what stood out for you watching him that you thought you could do to caricature him?
Well, I think other people can certainly do Trump more deftly than I can. I don't think I really do the greatest impersonation of Trump per se, but we're not doing it on film. We're doing it live on a TV show at 11:30 at night in front of a live audience. So there's a kind of blow it up, you know, and it's kind of the Macy's Day Parade of Trump. You know, it's a very larger than life thing. And I think in the back of my mind, maybe I could do him a little more precisely if we were in a different venue. But for this, you've got to pick a couple things, which is just his. I mean, I always say the same stupid thing to myself. I say, you know, left eyebrow up, right eyebrow down, stick your mouth out as far as you can, like you're trying to bite somebody's nose off. And kind of growl with that irritability. You know, Trump is someone, to me, where the things I try to lock into and kind of hold on to for just for that brief 5 minutes of the cold opening is that he's not having any fun. He doesn't shut up about how rich he is. He doesn't stop talking about how much money he has and how much privilege he has. And he just seems miserable. I mean, if he's an advertisement for wealth and privilege, then good God, I think it's terrible. But anyway, so we did that. And he was always straining to find a stronger, better word in his language and never found it. So you'd have him pause. You know, Trump is always sitting there going, you know, the people that I work with, they're just really, really the most fantastic people. They're fantastic. You know, he just always, you see him digging in some bin. He's like in a filing room looking for another word. And he'll say, my son-in-law, Jared, is really just, he's an amazing young guy. He's amazing. He's just amazing. I think he has like a glossary of about like 200 words.
So Trump has negative tweeted about Saturday Night Live and about you in particular. I'll read a couple of tweets. This is October 16th at 7:14 a.m. Watch Saturday Night Live, hit job on me. Time to retire the boring and unfunny show. Alec Baldwin portrayal stinks. Media rigging election. December 4th, 12:13 a.m. Just tried watching Saturday Night Live. Unwatchable. Totally biased. Not funny. And the Baldwin impersonation just can't get any worse. Sad. And you responded, release your tax returns and I'll stop.
Yes.
He hasn't released them. You haven't stopped.
What was your
first reaction when you realized that Trump was tweeting about your impersonation?
It is kind of absurd. Well, I mean, regardless of whether you're the subject of those tweets or one of them, because all those tweets are kind of a multiple warhead, you know. He takes on the show. He takes on the press. He takes on me, all in 140 characters. So he does have some skill there. But I think it's absurd that he would be doing that in the direction of anybody, any kind of comedy programming that's parodying him or commenting on him, whether it was Jon Stewart in his day and so forth, or Colbert now. I find it amazing that he's doing that. And then when you think about it's me that he's doing it with, I find that even more surreal.
So let's talk a little bit about your memoir, Nevertheless. One of the things I really enjoyed learning about you is that growing up in Long Island, Massapequa, Long Island, you watched a lot of old movies on TV. I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn, and watched a lot of the same movie shows that you did, The Late Show, The Late Late Show, The Early Show. What was the Sunday afternoon thing you mentioned?
Picture for a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, Picture for a Sunday afternoon. And then you explain in your book that you bonded with your father watching like the late night old movies on TV. And you bonded with your mother when you faked being sick and stayed home from school and watched daytime TV with her.
Right. Dinah Shore.
Yeah, so I just thought it was so interesting that you became an actor and like TV, you know, like movies and TV were your ways of bonding with your parents. But so with the movies that you saw on TV, what are the movies that you saw the most that made the biggest impression, ones that you were able to watch over and over?
I guess, you know, when I was young, my dad, I'm perfectly willing to see now that what I loved and what I was doing and what I was opening up my mind to was to communicate with my dad. He would come home from work. He'd lay on this daybed in the den of our house. There was a TV. And I'd sit in a chair. And, you know, this was his sacred time, his alone time. No one could get near him or really, really bother him in the evening because, you know, he'd get home sometimes, you know, 10, 11 o'clock. And sometimes I think he stayed away. Maybe he pretended he had a job at night and he was really just doing something else. But it was tough. You know, he would come home and six kids and my mom. And I think everybody was just stressed out. And he'd be reading the capsule reviews in the Times TV section. And my dad would say, wow, how green was my valley. That's a good one. And 11:30, I'd say, can we watch How Green Was My Valley, Dad? I was 10 years old. He'd say, no. It's too late. He said, well, let's just watch 10 minutes. 10 minutes, 15 minutes of How Green Was My Valley, and you have to go to bed. I'd be like, sure, Dad, sure. Work like a charm. TV comes on, How Green Was My Valley. My dad passes out on the couch. He falls asleep. And I watch all of How Green Was My Valley. I watch the whole thing. Some nights I actually got away with watching a piece of the next one on. It was on like 1:15 in the morning.
In your memoir, you write that you learned lines from a lot of different films. So I'm going to ask you to do a passage from a film that you still remember.
Oh,
yes?
God.
Yeah.
Well, I always remember like just lines that I used to think were funny. You know, like those men. I loved men in movies who they always won, and they won in some funny way. Like there's that time that Bogart has got Alicia Cook Jr. has gotten him in the hotel, and he's walking him up to go meet Sidney Greenstreet in Maltese Falcon. And he's got the gun on him, and Bogart disarms Alicia Cook Jr. And he gets the gun away from him, and he points the gun at him and says, come on. And he says, that'll get you in real good with your boss. And I just love things like that where the guy, the hero, wins. And they really were great bad guys. I mean, they made the bad guys really bad, you know, really bad. And, you know, Treasure Sierra Madre, what's 3 times $35,000? I bet you $105,000 you fall asleep before I do, he'd say to those guys. So all those movies that, Bogart was like the great one. He was such a great actor and so different and so unique. But Cagney Bogart, Paul Muni.
Wait. I'm going to stop you. Everybody used to do impressions of Cagney. All the comics used to do impressions of Cagney when I was growing up.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have a Cagney impression?
Cagney was, I always get the line wrong because I went back and saw the movie, Public Enemy. I think he's got the guy in the trunk of the car where the guy goes, open up, open up. I can't breathe in here. I can't breathe. I don't have any air. And Cagney stands up and Cagney goes, air? You want air? I'll give you air. Boom, boom, boom. And he shoots into the trunk of the car. And I thought, God, what a horrible thing to say. You want air? I'll give you air. And we used to do that. I'd lay in bed next to my mother. My mother was trying to sleep. She would take naps every day. This is when I was like 10, and my mother had 6 little kids. You realize, I look now with my children, my young children, and I realize my mother had little children. So they need to be constantly watched. When my brothers and I got to be, all of us got to be 16, 15, 14, my mother just opened the door and kicked us out of the house and said, I don't care what you do. Just make sure you don't get hit by a car, but get out. And she banished us from the house. In the driving snow, she evicted us from the house. She just didn't want us in the house so she wouldn't lose her marbles. But when I was a little boy and I'd lay in bed next to my mother would be sleeping. And in this very quiet voice, you'd hear me going, air? You want air? I'll give you air. Boom, boom, boom. My mother would hit me. She'd say, lie still.
You also used to watch Chiller Theater when you were growing up, which was the Saturday night, late night monster
Chiller,
movie that Zachary hosted. And my older brother would watch that, and I was allowed to stay up for a few minutes of it. And it terrified me. I fell in love with monster movies, you know, because of the things that really scare you then you fall in love with afterwards.
Lugosi, all those movies.
Yeah, what really scared you when you were young? Yeah.
Dracula. Mm-hmm. I'd watch Dracula 50 times. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make, he'd say.
I love
that. And I love that one. And I love my favorite line. Matthew Broderick and I always regale each other with our Claude Rains line readings from Invisible Man because we're Invisible Man junkies. And whenever Matthew and I see each other, we look at each other and say, sit down, you fool, and let's have a decent fire. Because he says that to his enemy in the film. And the very first movie that I watched with my dad that made me an addict was we would watch a Million Dollar Movie, and Sorry, Wrong Number came on with Barbara Stanwyck and Burt Lancaster. And that movie scared the hell out of me. The idea that a man would pay people to kill his wife to collect the insurance. And I was probably 8 or 9 years old. And I was a complete idiot. I look at my dad and say, gee, Dad. I was like Dondi out of Dondi Comics. I was like, gee, Dad, do people really do that, Dad? They pay people to kill their wives to get the insurance, Dad? And my father would like glare over at my mother and go, indeed they do. Yes, indeed they do.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alec Baldwin. He's been doing his impression of Donald Trump pretty regularly on Saturday Night Live. His new animated movie, The Boss Baby, was number one at the box office last weekend. And he has a new memoir called Nevertheless, in which he writes about his life and career. Baldwin grew up in Massapequa, Long Island. His father was a dedicated high school teacher who didn't make much money and was supporting 6 kids. Baldwin vowed not to be in the kind of financially unstable position his father was, so there was a period where he accepted the acting roles that paid the most, which he now regrets.
There's a spell of time there where I go and I don't do Prelude to a Kiss on Broadway, and I go to The Marrying Man because they're going to pay me $1 million for the first time in my life. And I thought, well, that's who I am. I'm a guy that's going to star in films, and you're going to pay me a lot of money, and that's the career I want to have. And I don't go to it. And the movie was not a good movie. And I should have done Prelude. I should have followed the instincts I had up till then. Now, my instincts, if I followed them, I would have gone to Broadway. And I would not have chased the money, but I did the money instead because people talked me into that. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of guys that sat me down when I was shooting Red October, and in so many words, they said to me, you're it. We're going to put some serious films together and get you up there in the stratosphere and up there with Mel and Kevin and blah, blah, blah. And I just said to myself, I sat and talked to them, and I thought, all of this sounds great, except the movies suck that you want me to do. And doing Streetcar was an attempt to kind of jerk the wheel back in that direction and try to say, well, this is who I am, and the creative is important to me. And I kind of was ashamed at how I had handled all of it. I felt badly.
how did you decide to pursue acting in the first place? You were interested in politics. You ran for the president of George Washington University when you were a student there. You lost. And then it seems like a big switch from politics and history to acting.
Well, I think that, you know, the year ahead of me was kind of a gut year, as they used to say. I don't know if they use that term now, but I had done all my hard classes in my sophomore and junior year and got involved in student politics because it interested me to a degree, and I wanted to go into politics and run for office and get a law degree to help supplement that or help to facilitate that. So my girlfriend broke up with me. I was in love with this woman when I was very young, and she said, I can't be with you because you're not Jewish. Her grandparents told her to break up with me, and she did. Her grandparents said, lose the sheikh, it's a boyfriend. And she did. And I go to visit a friend of mine. She says, why don't you audition for the acting program? I auditioned for the program. And I think because I was...
Why did they say audition for the acting? Well, like, what evidence was there that you had any...
I would hang out with them and they'd say, oh, you're so funny and you're such
oh,
a...
Oh, okay.
You're such
an
animated
person. Were you doing impressions
person.
For them, too, of your favorite
I would do,
movie
yeah.
lines?
Air? You want air? Right. I'll give you air. Right. Whatever you were doing, your shtick. And then the next thing you know, a friend of mine who was at NYU, her roommate was in the acting program. I went to visit my friend, and her roommate said, my God, you should audition for the program just for the hell of it. And I did. And I got in, and they gave me a need-based scholarship for the whole year there. And the joke in my family is that I called my parents, and my mother was apoplectic. I mean, she was screaming on the phone. What is wrong with you? And I said, I'm going to leave GW to go to NYU to study acting. And I said, now, Mom and Dad, I said, when I go back to New York as a returning New Yorker, I'm eligible for all of this financial aid that I lost when I left town. So when I went to D.C., so actually NYU is more expensive than GW, but it's going to cost you less money. And my father literally went, well, let's hear him out. Let's hear him out. And I moved there, and I said to myself, I'll do this for a year. 1 year only. I'll study. And if I get any kind of encouragement that I might have a career in this, I'll do it. And if I don't, I'm out. I'll finish my poli-sci program and go to law school, and that's that. And I did the program for a year and got out, and I got a job right away, and I never stopped working since then.
So I want to read a couple of things that you were quoted as saying. In 2008 in The New Yorker, you said, I'm tired of being somebody else. I spend the waking hours of my life saying things that other people think and say and do and behaving as someone else. I want to be me. I want to be myself. 2014 in New York Magazine, it's goodbye to public life in the way that you try to communicate with an audience playfully, like we're friends, beyond the work. I probably have to move out of New York. I just can't live in New York anymore. Everything I hated about LA I'm beginning to crave, like living behind a gate, getting in a car, minimal public interaction. Are those things still true of how you feel? Right. Are you still tired of being somebody else? Because it sounded like you wanted to give up acting
when you said that. Well, not tired, but I want to do a little bit less of it. Like I do the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Someone said, what do you love about the podcast? I said, it's my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not working for somebody else. Even when I did 30 Rock, that was Tina's thing. We were all were kind of working for Tina. You know what I mean? It was all, none of the writers ever came to me and said, what do you want to do? Which was a good thing. They had the recipe, and thank God we did what they wanted to do because it won all these awards. But everybody does a thing that they're a part of. Then there's a thing they want to do. And I want to do what I want to do. I mean, I work with other people, and it's great. And I work in what is traditionally a collaborative medium. But I've done that for 35 years. 37 years. And what I want to do now is other things which are more that I produce, that I do what I want to do. I want to do that.
But this leads to something I really wanted to ask you. Since you interview a lot of people on your podcast, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Are there questions that you hate to be asked as an actor who's often interviewed that you won't ask your guests or that maybe you ask anyways because they're actually good questions. Do you know what I mean? Like, how does being an actor who is interviewed a lot inform the kind of interviewer you are and where you'll go and where you won't go?
Well, the two quick things about that, and I'm often compared negatively to you, in fact.
Oh, you're welcome.
Say, Right, exactly. Now, I'm often compared negatively to you, where they'll say, you know, why don't you shut up? And why can't you be more like Terry, who's doing an interview, which isn't about Terry? And I'm having a conversation with people, and where my experiences overlap theirs, and I talk about how mm-hmm. that affects my life, mm-hmm. I really don't care. And the new rule we've had, I shouldn't say new, but over the last two seasons, last season and this season again, we continue to ratchet it tighter and tighter, where you just cut me out. Emily Botine, who's my producer, all I do when I get a draft from her, and I go, Emily, cut all that out from 12 minutes and 30 seconds to 14 minutes where I won't go on and on about this. And I cut myself out and out and out. But my show is about appreciation. I only ask people to come on the show. I'm completely self-determining about who's on the show. I pick people who I think they've got a breadth of a career. I think they're probably good talkers. So what happens is my show, it's about people who I'm fascinated with or I love. And I'm unapologetic about that. I mean, I'm practically, you know, rubbing Peter Frampton's feet when I'm on the show with him. I mean, so in love with him, you know. I give everybody a foot rub. That's the goal, is for just to relax and have a good time. And if you don't pressure them, if you don't push them and prod them, they'll tell you what they want to tell you. I never push. I talk to them, and 20 minutes goes by, and they're telling me all about who they are anyway without me having to try to snatch it from them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I do.
Okay. Just one more question. I haven't heard you as the announcer of the New York Philharmonic radio broadcasts. I know you fell in love with classical music being stuck in traffic jams in L.A. and listening to the radio. Do you do, like, an announcer voice, that the kind of
yes.
voice you grew up with?
The guy that was the booth announcer, Robert Molly, who was on the WOR booth announcer, they'd have the guy live in the booth in case there was a technical difficulty in the pre-digital age, and Molly would say, next on Million Dollar Movie, Barbara Stanwyck tells Gary Cooper where he can go on Ball of Fire. And I sit there and go, my God. And when I did the Philharmonic, they'd say to me, you've got to articulate because you're going to be saying names. It took me 40 minutes to learn how to say Christoph von Dachnanyi. I was reading it going, what the, Christoph, I'd say, the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, Christoph von Dachnanyi conducts the New York Philharmonic. And I always pop the word New York because I'm marketing, I'm selling. So I always go, this is the Mahler Ninth Symphony. Lauren Mazel conducts the New York Philharmonic. Because I'm helping to sell the product. I'm a pitch man. Anyway, thank you so much.
Alec Baldwin, thank you so much.
I love your show. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for doing it. Alec Baldwin's new memoir is called Nevertheless. He stars in the new animated movie, The Boss Baby. Valerie June is a Tennessee-born singer-songwriter who made a splash with her 2013 album, Pushing Against a Stone. On her latest album, The Order of Time, Valerie June reaches back to her roots in Southern gospel, reconciling it with her current life in Brooklyn, New York. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Been a few years since we've heard that Valerie June voice, the high-pitched twang that toggles back and forth between crisp enunciation and a slurred drawl. On the song I just played, called Shakedown, she's joined by two brothers and her father on backup vocals. The song builds to a rock band rave-up, but in the midst of all that, Valerie June sounds as lonely as if she was singing to herself in an empty room. On this album, The Order of Time, June is especially effective when she gets that alone-in-a-room sound going. Listen to the way her voice seems to bounce off the walls of a heartbreak hotel room on a song called If And.
Some things in life happen to flow. Sometimes you die, know it's ready to go.
Elsewhere, June's voice takes a slow crawl away from the wreckage of a romance on the song Love You Once Made. Beginning with just vocal and bass, the melody is soon joined by an organ and drums. An electric piano flutters around June's voice as she sings about a faded love that always threatens to loom up in front of her, the memory newly fresh and painful.
You can leave now. You did all you could. You could have said 10,000 words, done all the things that you should. But time's hands turn to point straight your way. Memory faded to dust of a love you once made. There were the nights of the midnight.
Born in Tennessee in the early 80s, listening to gospel music in her church and getting exposed to soul, blues, and rock from her music promoter father, Valerie June moved to Memphis to start her performing career, playing guitar and banjo as well as singing. A few years ago, she relocated to Brooklyn, but that hasn't turned her into a jaded hipster. Just listen to the glowing wonder she brings to Astral Plane. It's a song that treats the spiritual and the mystical as being as substantial as the guitar she strums.
Is there a light you have inside you can't touch? A looking glass can only show you so much. Follow the signs, slowly but steady. Don't rush. The day will come when you're ready. Just trust. Dancing on the Astral Plane, holy water cleansing rain.
One of my favorite songs on this album is Just in Time. It sounds like a New York piece of music. Its beat might have been lifted from the Shangri-La's girl group. Its violin and cello, a minimalist version of a Phil Spector production. Her voice, the sound of a solo doo-wop act. The title Just in Time quickly takes on an added meaning, wiping away the distance between different decades of music to make the song seem of its time and timeless. Just in Time, the album title The Order of Time. June's sense of time as fluid and multidimensional is all over this collection. It's something close to what science fiction writers call a time slip, a notion she gets at on a soul ballad here called Slip Slide On By. Yet for all this, Valerie June resists becoming too airy or ethereal. She also understands the way certain pop genres, certain ways to phrase and shape a lyric, can break and mend a heart at the same time.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed The Order of Time by singer-songwriter Valerie June. When my guest Laura Jane Grace started to accept that she was suffering from gender dysphoria and wanted to transition from male to female, in addition to asking how this would affect her wife and their daughter, she had to ask how it would affect her band and her music. Laura Jane Grace is the founder, lead singer, and guitarist of the punk band Against Me, which released its first album, Reinventing Axl Rose, in 2002, and signed with Sire Records in 2007. She came out as trans in Rolling Stone in 2012. Her transition is reflected in Against Me's last two album titles, Transgender Dysphoria Blues and the latest, Shapeshift With Me. Reviewing Shapeshift on the NPR website, Jason Heller wrote, "It's raging, tender, organic, erotic, and liberating." Let's start with a song from it written by Laura Jane Grace. This is Delicate, Petite, and Other Things I'll Never Be. Laura Jane Grace, welcome to Fresh Air. Is there a story behind that song?
You know, that song was the song that came like kind of instantaneously. A lot of it has to do with coming from a place of feeling like you were unlovable or being made to feel ashamed of yourself in a physical way. And a little bit of internalized transphobia along with that too, and relating to the question of passing, specifically with the line, I want to be, this is a line often like, that's been repeated back to me that people I feel like intentionally, somehow subconsciously don't hear right of, I want to be more real than all the others. I want to be more real than all the rest. I want to be more so real you can see the difference. And people always like say it back as can't usually. And I always feel like that's like a subconscious thing.
So in May of 2016, at a sold-out concert in Durham, North Carolina, you protested the North Carolina law mandating that you have to use the restroom of the gender you were assigned at birth. So on stage, you took out your birth certificate, you set it on fire, and tell us what you said.
I said, goodbye, gender.
Yeah.
I just waved to goodbye.
But I think that's so interesting. You didn't say, goodbye, being a man, hello, being a woman. You didn't say, goodbye, Thomas James Gable, hello, Laura Jane Grace. You said, goodbye, gender. And tell us why you said that.
I guess, you know, getting to a point of maybe it was like 2-3 years into gender transition and kind of having a nervous breakdown and being just so sick of thinking of gender roles and what it means to inhabit being a man or being a woman, I was just tired of thinking about it.
So what does gender mean to you now? Do you see it as fluid, as ambiguous?
I as someone who's like kind of feels like they've been kind of mid-transition for a while, there has to be a level of fluidity to it, especially when traveling on an international level and interacting with the people in situations that I do, you know? And like, I feel like someone who's, you know, not under any illusion of whether or not I'm passing, I just am the way I am. And if people have a problem with that, then so be it, you know?
I'm glad you brought up the notion of passing. Like, do you want to pass as a woman or do you want to be seen as trans?
It's such a complicated question, you know, and like the one angle of like, what does it mean to pass? Well, of course, that's ridiculous. And who are you passing for? You know, that's like a ridiculous thought. The reality of it being, though, is that like the reason most trans people want to pass is so that they don't face threats of physical violence or discrimination. You know, then that oftentimes is the motivator for me of thinking like maybe I should get facial feminization surgery or get a tracheal shave so my voice goes up a register or something, you know. A good friend of mine, Bailey J, has a quote of plastic surgery won't fix a broken soul. So I feel like it's really like you're just like walking these tight ropes of like, you know, trying to like stay sane and trying to keep it together. It can sometimes be a scary place.
You know, in the process of transitioning to female, whatever we mean when we say that, are there like gender stereotypes of women that you want to avoid?
That plays into the question of like, what does it mean to be a woman?
Exactly.
You know, like,
yeah.
And so, like, how much of that is socialization and how much of that is, like, society? And you know, like, I definitely, like, realize similar pressures of, like, you know, okay, you decide you're going to transition, and then all of a sudden you're like, and now I'm still a public figure, and I've, like, and now I face the fear of, like, do I look fat in this dress? Like, you know, like, I have to do a photo shoot and I'm worried about the way I look. And, like, you know, I feel like just, like, all those pressures sometimes from a transition, like, standpoint are so unrealistic to navigate in like, a public eye. It's tough, you know? But, like, the reality of my upbringing and my socialization and the experiences I've had are what has made me who I am, you know? And that's my experience. And so, like, I don't see that making me any less of a woman or any less of a person. It's just different, you know? Like, I used to work as an auto mechanic. I've toured in a punk band for 20 years. The reason I dress the way I dress is because black jeans don't stain and you can wear them for days on end without having to do laundry. Like, that's, you know, I mean, that's just the reality.
Well, I think one of the great things about punk rock is, in addition to, like, redefining the music and redefining the level of musicianship you need to play it at some level, it also redefined, like, what beauty is or what you want to look like, what it means
completely.
And so do you feel like you're keeping to that standard in the sense that, like, beauty can be redefined? It doesn't have to be the standard of what we think of as pretty, you know?
For sure, 100%. And that was, you know, one of the very appealing things to me about the punk rock world when I was, like, 15, 16, especially stumbling onto, like, anarchist punk rock and activist punk rock and a scene that was really strongly feminist and anti-racist and anti-homophobia, anti-transphobia, all about body liberation, all about, like, you know, just being yourself. And that's, those are values I still strongly hold on to.
So another related question is how transitioning has affected your voice. I mean, you're taking hormones. I would think that hormones would maybe change your voice, and particularly as a singer, where, you know, your voice is part of, like, your singer and guitarist and songwriter. I mean, your voice is,
sure,
like, really important. So, you know, first of all, were you concerned about that it would change your voice in ways that might be unexpected? And what have the results been vocally?
No, I wish it would change my voice. It just doesn't work like that. It works like that if you're taking testosterone, it deepens your voice, but estrogen does not raise your voice.
Oh.
So I wish, sure, you know. But being that, like, being a singer, my voice just changes and does things that I cannot control. Right now, you know, like, I've got a little bit of a chest infection maybe, and being on tour, you know, we did, I think it was like 9 shows in a row. So my voice is going to do what it's going to do. I just can't control it, you know?
And what about how transitioning has affected your stage persona and what you wear on stage?
Well, I guess, you know, like, you know, talking about all these things, talking about what I wear on stage, talking about, like, voice, talking about, like, writing and everything like that and how transition affects these things. If anything, it's just, like, overall, all around, made me, like, kind of a more real, more there, present, and comfortable with myself person. Where, like, maybe if we were doing this interview, like, 10 years ago, I probably would be a lot less verbal and really not as talkative or able to answer your questions. It's just, like, it's put me in touch with myself. It broke down a wall. And that really, like, I guess after a point was what I realized was the more important part of transition, is if you're living a closeted life and you're living a life where you're, like, feel like you can't be yourself, and of course you're not acting like yourself, but once you embrace yourself and you come out and you, like, start living your authentic self and living as yourself, then you can just be who you are. And if that fits someone else's description of what it means to be someone, whatever, it doesn't matter. And I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of that, unfortunately, took going to a really dark place of, like, having a nervous breakdown or, like, you know, having your life changed in drastic ways. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
So you have several journal entries in your memoir, and I want to read an excerpt of a couple of them, if that's okay with you. In your journal entry from, I forget what the day it is, but it's in the year 2000, after you've tried on a dress, and you're still male at this point. So it's after trying on a dress with lace and black pantyhose and a bra, You write, I tell myself that it's the last time. Deep down inside of me, I know that I am not a mistake. I do not feel sick. I do not feel like a pervert. I am not gay. I am not a fag. I am not a drag queen. I am not a tranny. I am not a transsexual. I am not transgender. I am just her, a daughter, a sister, someone's girlfriend, just like all the other pretty college girls on campus. You've said you're not everything in there, but you said, I'm not a transsexual, not transgender. Where were you then in your mind compared to where you are now?
Pretty obviously living in a state of denial. I was probably 19 years old then, and I probably wrote the word transgender because I had only just heard the word transgender. It wasn't until way later I'd heard of the concept. I'd heard the slur tranny, I'd heard transsexual, but I didn't quite identify with any of those things in the concept of being trans. I don't know. I'm obviously very in denial in that entry. I didn't want to be any of those things at the time.
So there's a lot of anger in your early music, and you actually had a lot of anger during that period and had a lot of anger when you were an adolescent and a teenager. So looking back, do you think some of that anger was based on the gender dysphoria that you were not yet able to articulate?
100%. I mean, there's like no other way really to describe it or categorize it. Being stuck in cycles of that kind of binge and purge cycle where, engaging in any kind of like behavior that gave in to your dysphoria was then immediately met afterwards with like intense feelings of shame and self-hate, which then, I was a cutter. I was like actively sought out self-destructive things, like deciding like, I'm going to smoke cigarettes. This tastes terrible. It just made me throw up, but I'm going to keep going until I like these cigarettes. And then, thinking in my head, like, how can I get a hold of drugs? How can I find cocaine? And that's like 13 years old, because I didn't know what else was, I didn't know. I had no resources. I had no one to turn to talk about it. I used to go to a church group. The church paid for me to go to therapy. Church kicked me out of church eventually, because they just thought I was a lost cause. And there was just no words for it. Again, I didn't hear the term transgender until I was probably like 19 years old. Who wants to grow up to be something that, you feel like is going to cost you a normal life?
Who did you think you were? I mean, what did you think the problem you were experiencing was?
I thought I was quite possibly schizophrenic. And I thought that, sometimes I kind of romanticize that as like, oh, maybe I was like born with a twin soul and these two twin souls are like warring for control over me constantly. It just kind of drifted around there. But most of all, I thought it would pass. I hoped it would pass, and that it wasn't like a lifelong thing. So that's like the cycle of binge and purge. Like, okay, no more. I'm done. Now I'm a man. Now I'm going to grow up and I'm going to live the rest of my adult life and forget this ever happened.
How did your band react when you came out as trans?
It was all in all pretty smooth, I definitely like surprised everybody, I think, in a way where like I didn't plan on saying it when I said it. So it like was kind of messy in that it just came out of my mouth and it was like, here, deal with this information. And we were all just in the studio in a room talking and I came out with it. But it was pretty like business as usual, like very shortly after that. The only change really was just like pronouns, But I know from talking to like James in particular, who I've been best friends with since first day of high school, that, it put a lot of pieces together for him and made him understand a lot of things, whether that be lyrically or just like who I was as a person, the way we interacted.
Did the band stay together?
It changed. It, coming out kicked off a series of events that like the term transition like really failed to encompass, where when I came out, I was married and had a daughter, owned a house in St. Augustine, Florida, had two cars, had my own studio, and we were working on a record, and I had a band that was four people, and then gradually over the next like year and a half, 2 years, that all just started changing. And that wasn't to say anyone was transphobic or unsupportive or anything like that. It just like things were different. Things changed. And it, you know, a tree fell through the roof of my studio. That just happened. So it destroyed the studio. That was like all these things happening at once where I was like, okay, now we're moving from St. Augustine. And now I live in Chicago, and now I'm going, you know, now I'm separated. And just like band members left and things changed.
So you have a daughter from your second marriage. The marriage ended sometime after you came out as trans. And you write in your memoir that your daughter said to you at one point, I want you to be daddy again. So how did you deal with that?
You know, that was like...
And she was a child. I mean, she was probably like 6 or something when that happened.
No, she was like 3.
Oh, 3. Okay.
Yeah. That like that feeling, not her, like I definitely like broke me down then at that moment, you know, but like that overall feeling and that existential crisis like crushed me where, and it, you know, like the idea of like, I want to be her dad. I am her dad, you know, like that's my kid. No one else, especially like separating from her mother, like the feeling of like no one, I'll be damned if someone else is coming in here and all of a sudden going to be dad to my kid, you know, like maybe that's like a dumb, aggressive attitude to have about things. But as a parent, I refuse to apologize for any way I feel over the protection of my kid. But like, you know, it was something that I wrestled with and eventually just came to the conclusion of like I am her dad, you know, like no matter what. And she says female pronouns, she and her, and she understands that I'm transgender and I am still her dad. And she says dad. And it's something that's interesting, like that. I feel like there are certain things when you're trans that you like pick up on tics other people have or like assumptions other people make and things that people go to where people will often in front of the two of us refer to me as her mommy. And like, when we've never said that, you know, like or anything like that. It's just like people have a hard time just accepting the fact that sometimes things are different, you know, that, yeah, I'm trans and I'm someone's dad and I would like you to call me she or her. And please call me Laura.
Right. Okay. Laura Jane Grace, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Laura Jane Grace has a new memoir. Against Me's latest album is called Shapeshift With Me. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross. I'm forever your girl. Please, please, please say that you love me.